And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
The Earth is changing, and we humans are tethered directly to the currents of change. A recent study puts into graphic form the state of the world's oceans. And what do they show? That's coming up, as well as the weekly Earth Summit and Nature News, when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Well, here's the good news. Daylight Savings Time is scheduled to begin this Sunday. I've always welcomed that change in the spring. To me, it's like getting a new car. But it's funny, really, in that all we've really done is moved our perceptions a bit. But what a difference it makes. Suddenly, there's so much more time, and the day seems so much longer. Well, to a large degree, that's what today's show is about. Taking note of the differences a change in perspective can make. In segment two, we change our perspective on the oceans with the publishing of a new report out of UC Santa Barbara that helps us literally see the oceans as we have not been able to before. And following the weekly Earth Summit, which begins in just a moment, we get caught up on this week's Nature News. But first, I'm sure many of us can't understand why we can feel so passionate about our Earth while others seem not to give it a second notice. And within that statement lies the key to the paradox of compassion, which we turn our attention to now with the weekly Earth Summit. Welcome to the Weekly Earth Summit, the most important 15 minutes on Earth. I'm your host, Sydney Wildsmith, and today we hear from Dr. Daniel Goleman, who wonders why, although we are likely hardwired for compassion, yet too often we overlook it. So now, please welcome Dr. Daniel Goleman.
There was a very important study done a while ago at Princeton Theological Seminary that speaks to why it is that when all of us have so many opportunities to help, we do sometimes and we don't other times. A group of divinity students at the Princeton Theological Seminary were told that they were going to give a practice sermon, and they were each given a sermon topic. Half of those students were given as a topic, the parable of the Good Samaritan, the man who stopped the stranger in to help the stranger in need by the side of the road. Half were given random Bible topics. Then one by one, they're told they had to go to another building and give their sermon. As they went from the first building to the second, each of them passed a man who was bent over and moaning, clearly in need. The question is, did they stop to help? The more interesting question is, did it matter they were contemplating the parable of the Good Samaritan? Answer, no, not at all. What turned out to determine whether someone would stop and help a stranger in need was how much of a hurry they thought they were in. Were they feeling they were late? Or were they absorbed in what they were going to talk about? And this is, I think, the predicament of our lives, that we don't take every opportunity to help because our focus is in the wrong direction. There's a new field in brain science, social neuroscience, that studies the circuitry in two people's brains that activates while they interact. And the new thinking about compassion from social neuroscience is that our default wiring is to help. That is to say, if we attend to the other person, we automatically empathize, we automatically feel with them. these newly identified neurons, mirror neurons, that act like a neural Wi-Fi, activating in our brain exactly the areas activated in theirs. We feel with automatically. And if that person is in need, if that person is suffering, we're automatically prepared to help. At least that's the argument. But then the question is, why don't we? And I think this speaks to a spectrum that goes from complete self-absorption to noticing, to empathy, and to compassion. And the simple fact is, if we are focused on ourselves, if we're preoccupied, as we so often are throughout the day, we don't really fully notice the other. And this difference between the self and the other focus can be very subtle. I was doing my taxes the other day, and I got to the point where I was listing all of the donations I gave, and I had an epiphany. It was, I came to my check to the Save a Foundation, and I noticed that I thought, boy, my friend Larry Brilliant would really be happy that I gave money to Save a. Then I realized that what I was getting from giving was a narcissistic hit, that I felt good about myself. Then I started to think about the people in the Himalayas whose cataracts would be helped, and I realized that the phenomenology of what was happening to me was that I went from this kind of narcissistic self-focus to altruistic joy, to feeling good for the people that were being helped. I think that's a motivator, but this distinction between focusing on ourselves and focusing on others is one that I encourage us all to pay attention to. You can see it at a gross level in the world of dating. I was at a sushi restaurant a while back, and I overheard two women talking about the brother of one woman who was in the singles scene. And this woman says, my brother is having trouble getting dates, so he's trying speed dating. I don't know if you know speed dating. Women sit at tables, and men go from table to table, and there's a clock and a bell, and at 5 minutes, bingo, the conversation ends, and the woman can decide whether to give her card or her email address to the man for follow-up. This woman says, my brother's never gotten a card, and I know exactly why. The moment he sits down, he starts talking nonstop about himself. He never asks about the woman. And I was doing some research in the Sunday Style section of the New York Times, looking at the backstories of marriages, because they're very interesting. And I came to the marriage of Alice Charney Epstein, and she said that when she was in the dating scene, she had a simple test she put people to. The test was, from the moment they got together, how long did it take the guy to ask her a question with the word you in it? And apparently Epstein aced the test. Therefore, the article. Now, this is it's a little test I encourage you to try out at a party. Here at TED, there's great opportunities. The Harvard Business Review recently had an article called The Human Moment about how to make real contact with a person at work. And they said, well, the fundamental thing you have to do is turn off your BlackBerry, close your laptop, end your daydream, and pay full attention to the person. There was a newly coined word in the English language for the moment when the person we're with whips out their BlackBerry or answers that cell phone, and all of a sudden we don't exist. The word is pizzled. It's a combination of puzzled and pissed off. I think it's quite apt. It's our empathy, it's our tuning in, which separates us from Machiavellians or sociopaths. I have a brother-in-law who's an expert on horror and terror. He wrote The Annotated Dracula, The Essential Frankenstein. He was trained as a Chaucer scholar, but he was born in Transylvania, and I think it affected him a little bit. At any rate, at one point, my brother-in-law, Leonard, decided to write a book about a serial killer. This is a man who terrorized the very vicinity we're in many years ago. He was known as the Santa Cruz Strangler, and before he was arrested, he had murdered his grandparents, his mother, and five co-eds at UC Santa Cruz. So my brother-in-law goes to interview this killer, and he realizes when he meets him that this guy is absolutely terrifying. For one thing, he's almost 7 feet tall. But that's not the most terrifying thing about him. The scariest thing is that his IQ is 160, certified genius. But there is zero correlation between IQ and emotional empathy, feeling with the other person. They're controlled by different parts of the brain. So at one point, my brother-in-law gets up the courage to ask the one question he really wants to know the answer to, and that is, How could you have done it? Didn't you feel any pity for your victims? These were very intimate murders. He strangled his victims. And the strangler says very matter-of-factly, oh no, if I had felt their distress, I could not have done it. I had to turn that part of me off. I had to turn that part of me off. And I think that that is very troubling. And in a sense, I've been reflecting on turning that part of us off. When we focus on ourselves in any activity, we do turn that part of ourselves off if there's another person. Think about going shopping. Think about the possibilities of a compassionate consumerism. Right now, as Bill McDonough has pointed out, the objects that we buy and use have hidden consequences. We're all unwitting victims of a collective blind spot. We don't notice and don't notice that we don't notice the toxic molecules emitted by a carpet or by the fabric on the seats. Or we don't know if that fabric is a technological or a manufacturing nutrient that can be reused, or does it just end up in landfill? In other words, we're oblivious to the ecological and public health and social and economic justice consequences of the things we buy and use. In a sense, the room itself is the elephant in the room, but we don't see it. And we've become victims of a system that points us elsewhere. Consider this. There's a wonderful book called Stuff, The Everyday Life of the Hidden Life of Everyday Objects. And it talks about the backstory of something like a T-shirt. And it talks about where the cotton was grown and the fertilizers that were used and the consequences of the soil of that fertilizer. And it mentions, for instance, that cotton is very resistant to textile dye. About 60% washes off into wastewater. And it's well known by epidemiologists that kids who live near textile works tend to have high rates of leukemia. There's a company, Bennett & Company, that supplies Polo.com, Victoria's Secret. They, because of their CEO, who's aware of this, in China formed a joint venture with their dye works to make sure that the wastewater would be properly taken care of before it returned to the groundwater. Right now, we don't have the option to choose the virtuous T-shirt over the non-virtuous one. So what would it take to do that? Well, I've been thinking, for one thing, there's a new electronic tagging technology that allows any store to know the entire history of any item on the shelves in that store. You can track it back to the factory. Once you can track it back to the factory, you can look at the manufacturing processes that were used to make it, and if it's virtuous, you can label it that way. Or if it's not so virtuous, you can go into any store, put your scanner on a palm onto a barcode, which will take you to a website. They have it for people with allergies to peanuts. That website could tell you things about that object. In other words, at point of purchase, we might be able to make a compassionate choice. There's a saying in the world of information science, ultimately everybody will know everything. And the question is, will it make a difference? Some time ago, when I was working for the New York Times, it was in the 80s, I did an article on what was then a new problem in New York. It was homeless people on the streets. And I spent a couple of weeks going around with a social work agency that ministered to the homeless. And I realized, seeing the homeless through their eyes, that almost all of them were psychiatric patients that had nowhere to go. They had a diagnosis. What it did was to shake me out of the urban trance where when we're passing someone who's homeless in the periphery of our vision, it stays on the periphery. We don't notice, and therefore we don't act. One day soon after that, it was a Friday, at the end of the day, I was going down to the subway. It was rush hour, and thousands of people were streaming down the stairs. And all of a sudden, as I was going down the stairs, I noticed that there was a man slumped to the side, shirtless, not moving, and people were just stepping over him, hundreds and hundreds of people. And because my urban trance had been somehow weakened, I found myself stopping to find out what was wrong. The moment I stopped, half a dozen other people immediately rang the same guy. And we found out that he was Hispanic, he didn't speak any English, he had no money, he'd been wandering the streets for days, starving, and he'd fainted from hunger. Immediately, someone went to get orange juice, someone brought a hot dog, someone brought a Subway cop. This guy was back on his feet immediately. But all it took was that simple act of noticing. And so I'm optimistic. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Goldman. I wish to add a footnote to Dr. Goldman's wonderfully insightful talk. I'm intrigued by the image of mirror neurons, cells in our brain that respond to similarities between two individuals, what many researchers are attributing as the source of our empathy and ultimately compassion. There are so many examples, but one that I think really points this out, which we've all experienced, is to come across someone who is sad. Think about what happens. I think I speak for many when I say that there's a flash of connectedness where we ourselves feel sadness, but ours is empathic. Our voices soften, our bodies soften, our hands reach up to console. We speak directly to the person and ask them, "What's wrong? Is there something I can do?" These empathic and sympathetic reactions are likely honed, something that develops within us with experience. And as well, can become overwhelmed, as Dr. Goldman points out so clearly in his examples. But it makes me think of the importance of developing compassion in children, exposing them to the gentleness and wonder of our world, letting them experience firsthand the happiness of animals and their friendship, getting them close to creatures so that their eyes meet and the mirror neurons respond. And part of the paradox I sense in this is that in our world, there are literally fewer and fewer animals, fewer birds and crickets and frogs and foxes. And therefore, children may be growing up with a diminished sense of compassion for life. So as we gain an extra hour of daylight, help children you know take the time to notice. This is Sidney Wildsmith inviting you to join us next week for the most important 15 minutes on Earth. Here on the weekly Earth Summit. A brief reminder, I'm beginning to launch the Wildside News on YouTube with the Wildside News Update. When the Great Spirit moves me, I'll be offering my commentary on things I'm passionate about. Check it out regularly by going to YouTube and type in Wildside News. See you there. And speaking of news, here's this week's Nature News. Oil set a new record price of over $104 per barrel, driven to a large degree by prices in the commodity markets. The nation needs now to get used to these new benchmarks, which are not likely ever to lower to any significant degree. And the already pressed American consumer needs to get ready for $4 per gallon gasoline this year and the general rise in prices of virtually everything. This historic high price for gas is driving a sudden surge in innovative transportation design, with car makers across the board putting hybrids and now even talk of hydrogen-powered vehicles into the mainstream of life. And that's the good news. Missiles are being exchanged between crews of Sea Shepherd's Steve Irwin and the captain of the crew of the Nishan Mara, the Japanese whaling ship trawling for specimens for their research in the whale sanctuary off the southern shores of Australia. Members of the 33-man crew of the Steve Irwin tossed bottles with rancid butter and a super slippery chemical onto the deck of the Nishan Mara, while verbal missiles were broadcast back to the Steve Irwin from a loudspeaker on the Nishan Mara, with a woman's voice saying, "This is the captain of the Nishan Mara," and the subdued barrage continues. As yet, the two vessels have maintained a respectable distance from one another, unlike years past when the vessels actually collided. Sea Shepherd Captain Paul Watson continues his efforts to disrupt the operations of the Japanese whaling fleet, research fleet, in waters deemed sacred for whales. Both sides are appealing for support from the Australian government, within whose waters these battles rage. We will be following this story as it continues to develop. Environmental extremists are being blamed for the destruction of 5 showcase homes in Woodinville, Washington, which were willfully set ablaze by arsons. The Street of Dreams was about to open and was being promoted as a more eco-friendly site, based on a reduction in size and use of more earth-friendly materials. The Pacific Northwest appears to be a focus of various attacks by groups loosely allied as ELF, the Earth Liberation Front. Signs spray-painted with those initials were at the scene of the blaze. A series of trials have taken place and are currently being adjudicated, in which individuals are being prosecuted for similar arson crimes and association with ELF. ELF claims that to date no one has been hurt or killed as a result of their actions. Most environmentalists agree that such actions ultimately do more harm than good in the efforts to bring about change. Montana has announced a wolf hunting season for the fall. Hunters will be given permits to hunt and kill wild wolves, but not with the aid of helicopters, scents, traps, or poisons. This historic hunting season is contingent on the removal of wolves from the endangered species list, which is expected to take place by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service this Thursday. The state has chosen to set a wolf season based on the estimate of 447 wolves in the state, a number they argue could easily withstand a limited hunting season. Opponents of Montana's decision state that there is not enough research that has been done on the effects wolf hunting may have on the stability of wolf families and packs. The decision is expected to be challenged in the courts, which could postpone the opening of the wolf hunting season for years. Scientists are predicting a collapse of West Coast salmon runs again this year. Last year witnessed a decline to one-third the expected populations of Chinook salmon in the Sacramento River. Changes in ocean currents appear to be the cause, as these currents are responsible for a condition called upwelling, which stirs up waters from the bottom up and in the process initiates the growth of phytoplankton and zooplankton upon which the oceanic food web relies. The same condition in previous years led to the death of thousands of seabirds from starvation, as the oceans were lacking in the usual amount of food for fish and fowl. This year, however, may bring back a more normal dynamic of wind and sea currents, which would invigorate a return to more normal conditions. And that's the news. If you have a news feature, send it to the Wildside News at wildsidenews@cox.net. That's wildsidenews@cox.net. In just a moment, we head on out to Santa Barbara, where a newly released study on the status of the world's oceans makes things abundantly clear that the oceans around the world are indeed going through change. That's coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
There's a unique feature of the world's oceans that we have to learn to live with. Most of us don't have any idea what's happening in the deep and mysterious depths of the seas. And yet, radical changes are taking place almost everywhere. Up until now, it was difficult to really grasp the nature and extent of these changes. In just a moment, we talk with Dr. Ben Halpern, who provides an interpretation of what his new ocean maps have to share. That's coming up. Stay tuned. Microsoft is about to unveil its worldwide telescope that will allow you to explore the entire universe from your computer screen. Of course, Google Sky has had a similar option available to its Google Earth users. It's truly amazing that we can see to the ends of the universe and make it all available. But unfortunately, here on Earth, we are still relatively blind to the truths of our oceans. Uncovering the truth of their secrets is still a long way off, but we make progress as we can. This past week, a study by a team of ocean scientists resulted in a unique map that provides a detailed analysis of the state of the world's oceans. And it's quite a startling picture that emerges. One of the things that concerns me most, there's so many different aspects of what's happening on this planet, but what's happening to the oceans, it's really quite a story. And I try to cover different angles on this all the time. Recently, there's been a very interesting and very significant study that puts together a lot of information in a map form, which becomes instantaneously interpretable. And I think that that's really useful. One of the principals who's helped to put this particular map together is now going to join us, Dr. Ben Halpern. He's a marine ecologist at the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Dr. Halpern, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, give us a concept of this map, just the basic outline, and then we'll go into it more in depth.
Our project focused on trying to finally get kind of the big picture of how humans are affecting the oceans overall, sort of cumulatively, rather than just focusing on a particular activity. So people may have heard about the impacts of commercial fishing or climate change or land-based pollution alone, and those stories are important to tell and understand, but they don't give you the full picture. And we really wanted to understand, when you lay these things on top of each other, one on top of another, what does that do? What does that show us about how humans are affecting the oceans? And that's what we were able to do with these analyses.
That is such a powerful format. I've utilized that at various times in my life to study different things, different ecosystems and the various parameters. And it tells such an incredible story that you can't figure out with numbers.
That's exactly right. I mean, there's too much going on for people to really kind of pull together in their head, because each thing has its own, each stress has its own way of affecting each ecosystem differently, and that's just too much for us all to pull together. And so what we did is provided the framework and the tools for pulling that all together, so that, as you pointed out, you can very quickly just look at this map and immediately get a sense of a meaningful understanding and estimate of the impact that humans are having on the ocean.
You've actually been able to put this into a visual form where the Earth is rotating, and you're able to kind of take a little quick tour around the planet and see the effects. You kind of interpret this in a variety of different parameters in terms of the effects.
There's a couple aspects of what we did that I think are important to point out. One is we looked at data that covered the entire planet, so that we had the full global scope. But we looked at fairly high-resolution data so that we could understand what's going on in each part, specific part of the ocean, and compare it to every other part of the ocean. So we get a relative estimate of how one area is doing compared to another. And a key part of being able to do that was another aspect of the research, where we accounted for the way that marine ecosystems respond differentially to different stresses or different human activities. So, for example, nutrient input has been shown to be a big problem for coral reefs, but it's not nearly as big of a problem for, say, soft sediment, shallow areas, which is another ecosystem type. And the fact that they respond differently is important to capture, and that's exactly what we did in our analysis. So we can look at the global statistics, how much of the ocean is being affected by human activities and the condition of that. And that's one thing we did. We can also compare how ecosystems are doing relative to other ecosystems. So what are the most threatened ecosystems? What are the most impacted ecosystems? So we were also able to do that.
And in terms of that analysis, why don't you give us the categories of threat?
We we had 17 different human activities or impacts of human activities that range from climate change to commercial fishing to land-based pollution to invasive species, et cetera. There are areas that are heavily impacted by most of these, including many of the coastal areas near large human populations. And in these areas, like the North and Norwegian Seas and the South and East China Seas, along the eastern seaboard of the United States and the Eastern Caribbean, along the coast of India and Sri Lanka, these areas all have very high impact from the collection of human activities. And in these areas, the oceans are fairly heavily degraded and, you know, and nothing like what one might consider a natural state for the ocean. Mm-hmm. But there are places where very few of these impacts occur. And these places are what we call areas of very low impact. I wouldn't call them pristine, probably, because we found that no single spot on the planet is untouched by any human activities. And so there are places that have very low impact. We found about 3.5% of the oceans falls into this category of very low impact. A lot of that is in the poles, where people tend to not go for the most part. But there are scattered little patches of very low impact waters around the world. Most countries have at least some of this area that's in very low impact. And on the maps, it shows up as blue. Mm-hmm. We've color-coded it so you can quickly capture, you know, visually the impact we're having. The most heavily impacted places are the bright red ones.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And they show up very clearly, and it makes sense. You'll find, as I looked at the map, for example, that, of course, the eastern seaboard of the United States, the area around England and then Norway surprised me. It seemed as if the coastal areas of Norway, am I interpreting the map correctly with that?
That's right. So the North and Norwegian Sea, which is up around Norway and Great Britain, there's a lot of oil and gas development in those waters. There's a lot of very large ports and a lot of land-based pollution from the continent of Europe that runs off into those waters that bring in invasive species and there's heavy commercial fishing up in those areas, so a lot of those oceans and that water up there has been heavily affected by many different human activities.
I always think of Norway as one of those pristine areas, the fjords, and but apparently, particularly on the western coast, that certainly is not the case.
Yeah, well, that's at least what our analyses show. So, I mean, you know, one thing is there's, you know, we can't. Our analyses don't allow someone to zoom into a tiny, tiny patch of water, say, off the back yard of your vacation home, and it's here. You know, that's too fine a scale for what we've done. And so there very well may be some very small patches up in that part of Norway that are still in good shape. But in the bigger picture, that general area has been heavily affected by human activity.
And then, of course, most of the coastal regions of China, which also then embraces Japan, are heavily impacted as well. That would be expected.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's probably not too much of a surprise.
No, not at all. Well, if you were to look at the whole picture, what's sort of an analysis of the state of the oceans based on this wonderful study that you've done?
Well, I'd say it's both alarming and encouraging. It's alarming because there's so much of the area that's been heavily impacted. We found 41% of the oceans is in a heavily impacted state. That's a lot of area for what is a very vast resource. The oceans are huge, and yet we've affected such a large part of it. That's kind of the alarming and surprising and worrisome message from our results. Where the encouragement and opportunity comes in is that as you look at the map, you'll see that it's not one big uniform blob of impact. There's a lot of spatial pattern to it, and that pattern provides opportunity because it means that there are places that are more and less impacted within any particular region. So a single country, no matter how small of an area they have of the oceans, has opportunity to set aside parts that are less impacted or think about ways to better manage those areas that are more impacted. And our results provide a lot of information for how you can move forward with better, more intelligent ocean management to allow for all these activities to continue to occur, but in a way that doesn't affect the oceans as much.
Were you able to discern from the study the top three impacts on the oceans?
Yes, we did do that, and there's two ways to ask that question. One is just how much of the ocean is being affected by it, and the other is how large is the impact. It's the latter one that we find to be a bit more interesting, and it really depends also on what you're focused on. If you look globally, by far the largest impact is coming from climate change, and we measured that through three ways: ocean acidification, changes in sea surface temperature, and increases in UV radiation. And all three of those are having very large impacts globally. But if you focus just on coastal waters, which is a meaningful thing to do because most of the things that we get from the ocean that we care about, fish, clean water, biodiversity, all these things that people often value in the oceans comes mostly from coastal waters. And if you look at coastal waters, climate change is still a major driver of impact in these waters, but most of the other 17 impacts that we look at are also having a very large impact on these coastal waters. So land-based pollution and nutrient runoff become major players in causing degradation in the coastal waters. Commercial fishing, artisanal fishing, all of these are having significant impact on coastal waters.
In terms of climate change, there is this issue of the rising ocean temperatures, but as well that then interacts with the increasing carbon dioxide levels in the air, which kind of has a multiplicative effect. Were you able to document any of those areas where that may be actually occurring more than others?
Well, it's actually a really important point you raise that, you know, it's really hard to account for those kinds of interactions because, for the most part, very little is currently known about them. So we, in our models, assumed everything was just additive, so you just sum everything up. But like you point out, there's plenty of, at least initial evidence, that things interact to multiply their effect. So our results are probably conservative, and things in the oceans are probably worse even than we found in our maps. But we weren't able to explicitly account for those just because so little is known, both about the types of interactions and then the spatial pattern of where those interactions are happening.
One of the things that was so much in the news probably 3-4 years ago were the impacts on the coral reefs. And for some reason, that I guess because there's so many other things now that we're becoming aware of, but the impact on coral reefs seems to have disappeared from the media and our awareness. What is the status based on your studies of coral reefs right now?
It is of grave concern, and our analysis confirmed that globally, coral reefs and mangroves, which also get a lot of attention, are heavily, heavily impacted ecosystems. But what we found is that other ecosystems are even more impacted than those, and they're ones that people may not really pay attention to much or even think about.
Well, let's talk about those, because I think it's important for us to talk about those things we don't otherwise pay attention
right.
to.
So ecosystems that came out as even more impacted than coral reefs include rocky reefs, which are in primarily in temperate waters. There, you get them a lot off the coast of California here. Often they have kelp forests on them, but when they don't, they're called rocky reefs. They're very diverse, they're very productive, and also very impacted. And even more impacted and more important are the continental shelves. And this is the part of the ocean as the continents drop off. It's at about 200 to 500 feet deep, and in these areas, it's where a lot of the fisheries productivity occurs, where a lot of gas, oil and gas development occurs out in the ocean. These areas are really productive for a lot of the resources we get out of the oceans, but they're also very heavily impacted by human activities. They're the most impacted ecosystems on the planet.
You know, I saw a rather interesting photograph and story recently about images being picked up off of Google Earth from the satellite imagery, which really showed literally the tracks of some of the bottom trawling, literally the pathways in some of the shallower areas, particularly off the coast of Louisiana. And it was dramatic, but even more so was the image of the mud cloud, the sediment that was stirred up in massive areas as a result of that people hadn't been paying attention to, and it was very graphically portrayed. What about the effects of bottom trawling, which I consider to be immoral, one of the most reprehensible things we're doing to the planet right now, but I'm just curious what your studies were showing in terms of their impact.
Well, yeah, we included that as one of the layers in our analyses, and it's definitely both widespread and has a very heavy impact where it does occur. So as you alluded to, the practice of bottom trawling, for the most part, drags big, heavy nets across the bottom and pretty much destroys everything in its path. It's not complete, of course, but it really gets a lot of stuff. And when it's dragged over the sediment, the soft bottom, you get these plumes of sediment that you saw in those images. And there are a lot of consequences, not just from the direct impact, but then that sediment settles back down and buries animals that makes it hard for them to live. So there's a lot of consequences to bottom trawling, fishing, that do make it one of the most damaging impacts of human activities on the ocean.
Do you think in the future we're going to see some ability to limit this? Now, maybe you actually enlighten me on this one, because I don't know the answer to this. In terms of where bottom trawling primarily is taking place, because I heard an estimate of perhaps 10,000 different vessels that are involved in bottom trawling. It shocked me. But do you know where most of that is taking place, in the deeper waters, the shallower waters? Where would a person find it mostly?
The trawl fishermen don't want to drag their nets over really rocky bottom because it destroys the net. So they, for the most part, try to focus on the soft bottom areas. And there actually are very large no-trawl zones being set up in various parts of the U.S. in order to try to limit where and how much trawl fishers drag their nets. But you're right, I've heard that same number of about 10,000 boats. They, you know, that's a lot of boats going over a lot of area, but they often go over the same area many times within a year. And so that means those areas are just being hammered, but it also means that there are places that are not being affected by trawl fishers. It's a very spatially patterned activity that the fishermen, you know, choose where to go to avoid damaging their nets and also where the fish are, but and then there are also regulations to try to control where it goes on.
Well, in the open waters, that's the difficulty, is enforcement. It's just a challenge that's going to have to be done pretty much on a global basis here. And, yeah, your thoughts on that?
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, once you get outside the EED, the exclusive economic zone of countries, which goes out to 200 nautical miles, it's international water, and there are very few regulations for what goes on out there, not just for fishing, but for all types of activities. And it's really hard to enact laws. I mean, the whaling treaty that we often hear about is an example of something that's tried to be managed through international law because so much of it happens out in international water, and there are major challenges with that. So, you know, fishing, the boats that exist now for commercial fishing, some of them are massive. They're these industrial-scale boats, and the nets can be miles long, so that you can both in surface distance, but also they can go miles deep and, you know, drag the bottom of oceans in very deep areas. So there's very little part of the ocean that can escape the pressures of fishing as well as other activities, and that's there is a real need for a strong international will, a multilateral movement to get some sort of better management of these international waters, because otherwise they're just going to continue to be really heavily impacted by humans.
I so much appreciate talking with you, Dr. Halperin, because this is such an issue for me. One of the things that I keep hearing, and I certainly would like your perspective on this, is that to a large degree, the large adult fish in the ocean are very much gone right now. How would you interpret that story that we hear?
I think that there's probably a lot of truth to it. I mean, all you have to do is read some of the historical accounts of what the oceans used to look like. If you go back to ship logs from the 1700s or earlier, the parts of the Caribbean Sea or out in the open Pacific, and the tales are of just vast abundance of all sorts of fish and sea turtles and whales. I mean, it's numbers of animals that I think people can't possibly imagine the oceans having now, because we just don't see it anymore. And so, you know, we've had a profound impact on the abundance of most of the big fish and mammals and organisms in the oceans. There are very few that are at their historic levels, and so it's hard for us to imagine what a pristine ocean actually probably once looked like.
I can recall when I was living in Oregon, had a friend who was a venture capitalist, and he was very much involved in fishing there. And through the years that I knew him, he became very depressed because his whole sector, in terms of the fishing in that area, disappeared because they had been fished out. We're kind of facing those types of issues, and I'm concerned now as we look into the future, as China in particular and Japan goes more modern, and the capacity to meet their needs. They're a very fish-intensive society. Are people beginning to think about what that could mean?
Well, you're exactly right, and unfortunately, they're already doing that. I mean, China is notorious for its international fishing fleet that goes around to a lot of places. There's a big, what they call, live fish trade in China, where the people there really like to be able to walk into a restaurant and see a fish tank with a fish alive swimming in it, point to it, and then eat that particular fish. It's very, very popular. The problem is that to bring fish live to a restaurant, you often only can, you have like a 90% mortality rate along the way. So you end up having to catch 10 times as many fish in order to supply that live fish trade. So the Chinese fishing fleets are everywhere, especially throughout Southeast Asia and into the Southern Oceans, just collecting huge numbers of fish for this, for a very, very large population that likes to eat live fish in the live fish trade. So it's already a major problem, and you're right that as they become a more and more developed society with more and more people with disposable income to participate in the live fish trade and eating these fish, it's going to become a larger problem.
I can only hope that as China really joins the 21st century, that they really join the 21st century and take on the responsibility as well. What I would like to know is now that you've done the study, what do you hope to accomplish? What do you hope that people can take from this and how it can be utilized to help restore and perhaps find new ways of resolving these dilemmas?
Well, that's a great question, and it's something that we thought a lot about, and it was a key motivation for our work. You know, we are working to collaborate with policymakers both at state and federal levels in the United States to try to help think about our results and how they can affect and influence state and federal policy for ocean management. So that's something that we're trying to do within our own ranks, but we really hope that people who see this work, you know, both get a better understanding of the impact that all of us are having on the oceans, but also understand that there's some personal responsibility behind this, that everything we do, from what kinds of fish we eat and how much fish we eat, what we throw away, how we throw it away, whether or not we recycle, all of these things can have an impact and do have an impact on the ocean. Just because we do it on land doesn't mean that it has no effect on the ocean. So there's a lot of opportunity for personal choice and personal responsibility to really change how we view the oceans and how we treat the oceans. And with that personal change, hopefully will come a new movement of better conservation and better management of our ocean.
One of the great stories that I hear about on a regular basis is that with the establishment of certain fish sanctuaries, for example, that the ocean has a terrific capacity to restore itself relatively quickly and effectively, at least in the certain species.
Well, that's exactly right, and actually I've spent a lot of my career studying that exact question. So if you look around the world, when you set up what they call marine reserves or no-take marine reserves, where you stop fishing within the boundaries of this park, essentially, like we have on land, but they're in water, when you do that, there's very rapid, very significant increases in the abundance and biomass of the fish and invertebrates that are inside the marine reserves. So for some species, this can happen within a few years. Others, it can take longer if they're very slow-growing, long-lived species. But in almost every single case that we've seen around the world, and there are hundreds of cases, we see these significant increases. And so you're right. It gives us real hope that if you just give the oceans a chance to heal, they will do it.
And there are some great examples, and it's becoming somewhat fashionable around the world in some areas.
Well, and it's not even just fashionable. It makes sense. I mean, I think people are becoming more aware of the need for conservation, but there's increasing evidence that this isn't just a conservation tool, that it can also benefit fishermen and a lot of other stakeholder groups that are interested in using the oceans for various reasons. So there's a real potential for a win-win situation here where the oceans win and people win by setting up these no-take marine reserves.
We're talking with Dr. Ben Halpern, who's a marine ecologist with the National Center for Ecological Analysis and Synthesis at UC Santa Barbara. Dr. Halpern, if people want to find out more about your amazing study, what's the best way for them to find you?
Well, we have a website that provides all of the maps and data that we use that people can browse around and also explain what we did, and also you can get the paper that we published. And the website is also a bit of a mouthful, but it's www.ncees.ucsb.edu/globalmarine, all one word.
Very good. Well, thank you so much. Maybe sometime in the future, I'd like to continue a conversation, particularly about some of as I've referred to them as sanctuaries. That would be really fascinating.
That would be great.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for your time.
I'll be posting a new Wild Side News update on YouTube this week. Be sure to see me there. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios until we meet again next Tuesday or any time on the archives when your voice of the earth rings true around the world here on the Wild Side News.